Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2022. This is the third case set for oral argument on today's calendar. It is the matter of Buckner versus Robichaud. I apologize if I've mispronounced that last name. Counsel, you are both familiar with our proceedings, our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And I'll just remind all the people participating today that there's no ability to record this Zoom proceeding. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, my name is Robert Gust, and I represent appellant Bernard J. Robichaud. May it please the court, I have the somewhat difficult task this morning, I guess, of telling three judges that judges do not have unlimited power. This case revolves primarily around the question of whether or not a judge has the power to sanction conduct outside the scope of a proceeding. And that sanctions and the award of sanctions are generally an abuse of discretion standard. But an abuse of discretion has to consider whether or not something can occur as a matter of law. So while it is an abuse of discretion standard, the underlying issue is it permitted by law is really more of a question of law. And I submit there is no authority that's been submitted to support the sanctions that were awarded in this case. Noteworthy in the initial motion for sanctions, there was no mention of inherent authority. And then in the judge's order, there was also no defined authority that is actually precedential.
What this Counsel, case really- Do you have any case law in Minnesota or elsewhere that says specifically that conduct outside of a court proceeding would not allow a court to use its inherent authority to sanction conduct?
Well, what you're asking, Your Honor, is basically to prove a negative. So I would
submit that. I'm just asking if there's any case law out there.
None that I have found in this context. However, in Minnesota, in the context of statutory authority, for example, in the Geske case and the Garcia case, they all take the same, that exact position that you have no, that a court has no authority, even when there's a statute that the court has no authority to sanction conduct outside of its proceedings. Now, courts always have had inherent authority with respect to their proceedings. Usually it's dealt with through a contempt type proceedings. But in this case, ultimately, all we're talking about is a breach of contract. And that's what this case comes down to. And so the sanctions that are being awarded are essentially, or that were awarded, are essentially sanctions for breach of contract. And I have cited authority for the proposition that there is no such cause of action in Minnesota as intentional breach of contract or even bad faith breach of contract. So all we have is something occurring completely outside of the context of a proceeding. Now, if you go through the Minnesota cases, most of which are actually unreported, it's interesting the way they address the issue. Most notably is the Patton case, Patton, P-A-T-T-O-N, like the general, where the issue was a case was dismissed because of a spoliation of evidence. And in that case, Minnesota Supreme Court went out of its way to say, this was not a sanctions case. This was not a dismissal based upon inappropriate conduct.
But as I read Patton, I mean, the sanction, if you will, in that case was the district court's conclusion that this plaintiff would not be able to present any of the evidence with respect to the partially burned up motorhome and the expert's evaluation of component parts that disappeared. That was the sanction. That dismissal of the action was just sort of a byproduct of the exclusion of the evidence. And it seems to me that Patton is very broad in terms of the sanction toolbox it gives to district courts in the exercise of their inherent authority. Why wouldn't attorney's fees be a sanction that would be in that broad toolbox?
Because attorney's fees are very specifically, and the Supreme Court consistently says, attorney's fees are awardable only if there's a contract that provides it or if there's a statute that provides it. Now, in addition to that, the Supreme Court has established all of the rules of contempt, which allow certain sanctions in certain circumstances, although generally the attorney's fees sanctions and the awarding of the other party's attorney's fees is generally a statutory 549.211 or a contractual, one way or the other. And
didn't the Supreme Court ultimately affirm the district court's inherent authority to sanction a party for conduct? And that conduct occurred 3 years before the proceeding.
In Patton, the Supreme Court did affirm what happened and then went out of its way to explain what had happened was an evidentiary ruling, that there was an evident that as a result of the exclusion of the evidence, that there was no basis, that they could not withstand summary judgment because they had no evidence. Now, yes, it was something that happened, that it was conduct that happened prior to the proceeding. And Patton Court does reiterate some of the basic rules regarding inherent authority to the extent inherent authority does exist, but went out of its way to say this was not, I mean, that's the language within the case. This was not a dismissal based on a sanction. This was a dismissal based on a summary judgment motion for which they could not provide a defense because they were not allowed to put in that evidence. And in that particular case, that is part of a court's inherent function to kind of control the evidence that comes in and make sure the evidence comes in fairly and make sure a party's not prejudiced by something that's happened. And that is part of a court's essential function. In this particular case, we're talking about awarding attorney's fees for something that is not part of the court's essential function, because there are mechanisms for transferring attorney's fees in a situation like that if it was appropriate. And so all the cases relied upon by other than Patton, by the district court were unpublished and specifically not of precedential value. But if you read them, they actually don't really support the conclusion anyway. In the Bursaw case, there were several factors that supported the award of sanctions, only one of which occurred outside the context of a court proceeding. And the Court of Appeals made a point of that. Well, that it was based on a lot of things. And if, in fact, there was this inherent authority to award sanctions outside the context of a proceeding, there would be case law that said that explicitly said that, as opposed to these cases that take language kind of out of context in some cases. As, for example, in the Geske case, where the district court cited it for the proposition that there are circumstances where a district court can award sanctions outside the context of a proceeding. But then that citation proceeds to cite a number of statutes. And there's no dispute that if there is a statutory basis to award sanctions, there is a basis to award it because it's provided by statute. The question in this case is whether or not there is inherent authority for a court to sanction conduct that's completely outside of a proceeding, and to do so creates essentially a separate cause of action.
Was the conduct completely outside of the proceeding? The court was involved in this matter with telephone conferences and one thing or another. So you may be overstating the circumstances here.
Well, so for starters, the district court found that it was outside the course of a proceeding, and those findings are subject to an abuse of discretion, and I don't know why, a basis on which that discretion was abused. However, the district court then said, well, perhaps once the telephone conversation started, perhaps that could be considered a proceeding. Okay. Well, let's just say that was the case. Then the proceeding started in January of 2021. And the time between that first telephone conference and the actual transfer of the account was a matter of weeks, I think 5 weeks maybe. And nothing occurred during that 5 week period of time that is the basis for this motion. In other words, there was an arrangement, someone was sent down. There was a meeting held in Florida, which was held about 2 weeks later. Okay, so that's 2 weeks that goes by. Then the mail was delayed, and then there was a mistake in signing. So nothing about that conduct between that hearing and going forward is what's an issue.
Help me understand something. There was a mediated settlement agreement. How did that mediation come about? Was there some pending motion before some court?
No, and just to be clear, I did not represent the appellant below, but what my understanding and the way I presented it is there was some sort of a post-judgment hearing status conference, I believe. Mr. Eisen.
So it was a court. Was the mediation then court initiated?
And the court, I do not believe, appointed a mediator. At a status conference, the party said, I think we might have some other issues that we have to bring forward. And the court said, why don't you go to mediation
clearly
first?
It came about in response to some court activity. Is that right?
I think that would be a fair statement, yes. But I don't think that makes it part of a proceeding. I think if you look at the United States Supreme Court case of Kekkonen, which I've cited in my brief, a settlement agreement is unless it's actually incorporated into a court order, is not part of the proceedings. A settlement agreement is something that has to be enforced separately. And in the context of state court litigation, you may be able to enforce it in the same case that you're already in, because you already have a case.
The trial court's determination here was captioned just as the dissolution caption, was it not?
Yeah, it did continue with the same number, yes. So the same, there was not a new case filed.
Wasn't some separate proceeding to enforce an agreement or on a contract. It was part of, at least far as the court was concerned, part of the original dissolution proceeding.
That is captioned the same way. There was not a new filing fee paid or anything. It was captioned the same way, correct?
You seem to suggest, Mr. Gust, that if the court, by virtue of a rule, a statute, a contract, has an ability to impose attorney's fees as a sanction or as a matter of contractual relief, that the court can't at the same time turn to its inherent judicial authority. What case would suggest that is true?
Well, the respondent in this case keeps talking about inherent judicial authority, and I'm waiting for something, for any case that provides inherent judicial authority outside the context of a proceeding. Because as I've indicated, this comes down to a breach of contract. And if you're going to create a right where you can say, well, you know what, I don't like the way this person performed or failed to perform timely under this contract, I'm going to impose a new sanction. You've basically just changed the common law and the statutory law. And you've created a new remedy where there wasn't one and where there didn't need to be one. Because these things can be dealt with. I mean, for example, most settlement agreements that I'm involved in have a provision in it that for fee shifting in the event further action needs to be brought. And so I'm in the difficult position of, I don't think I should be the one having to prove that this inherent authority does not exist. I think someone should have to prove that it does exist. And none of the cases support a claim for inherent authority outside the case, outside the context of the proceedings themselves. So briefly, and that is, I mean, that is my principal reason for this appeal, is it is simply outside the case. But in the brief time I've got, I do want to address a couple of other things, because I think
the trial court went on to describe the conduct of your client. Is it your view that none of that conduct was the kind of thing that should bother a trial court?
It's my view that it's not the kind of thing that a trial court has the authority to do anything other than perhaps lecture about. I do mostly commercial litigation, and a lot of times, people are unreasonable in the positions that they take leading up to litigation. When it ends up in a breach of contract, that doesn't end up in, like I said, a claim for intentional breach of contract or malicious breach of contract. And so,
if in fact this mediated settlement agreement had been submitted to the trial court and the trial court had issued an order, you think the case would be different?
I do. because then it becomes I suppose it would depend on the specific language and the judge's intent, because generally judges don't want ongoing jurisdiction, ongoing whatever. But if the had been submitted and the judge had approved it, and it was part of the order, then I think that's changed. I think that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Deconin. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But in this case, it came...
You're saying then it would have been part of the proceeding, and you're saying as the status is now, it's not?
Correct. As of now, it's like just about all of my cases go to mediation and just about all of my cases settle in mediation. And if something goes wrong with that settlement agreement, that is an issue to be addressed by how I drafted the settlement agreement and not a matter of the judge does not have continuing jurisdiction because to enforce the settlement agreement of which the court had no role in either drafting or approving.
Do you think family law might be different because the dispute that ended up in the mediated agreement arose from the court's proceeding to start out with?
No, because I think all mediated settlement agreements arise out of proceedings in court. And I think specifically, I think judges, you know, I think in generally, actually the case law says, you know, like in front of that example, in the context of injunctions, the court doesn't want to be supervising, doesn't want to be doing all this stuff. The court wants to make decisions and be done. And so if a judge in a family law situation, there are certain circumstances where they take continuing jurisdiction, is my understanding. Like I said, I don't generally do family law. But if you have essentially a money dispute and it's resolved by a settlement agreement, then you have a contract. And that's what we have in this case.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Alan Eitzness, representing the respondent, Allison Buckner.
Counsel, is there some reason why the mediated settlement agreement was not submitted to the court and made part of the court's proceedings?
I think the only reason on that, Your Honor, was that no one anticipated there would be any issue with it. It was self-operative. The agreement provided for certain things to be done. No one assumed that someone would violate the agreement. And throughout the process, I was
Kind of a big assumption in a family law case, isn't it?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. But my client fulfilled her obligations under that mediated settlement agreement, and we assume Mr. Robichaud would do the same.
Remind me, what other issues were presented to the mediator?
The respondent, or the appellant rather, Mr. Robichaud, contended that there was some issue with non-disclosure of discovery during the process, and we disputed that, but we reached a settlement on that point. My client paid some small amount of property settlement back to Mr. Robichaud as a settlement to that particular issue. I think that the court
The trial court determined here, the counsel suggests that the court made a finding that this was not part of a trial court proceeding. Is that a finding technically, or is that a legal conclusion?
I think that was a judge's legal conclusion, Your Honor, because.
And you haven't challenged that in these proceedings.
That's correct. We have determined based on the law that the trial court clearly has the inherent authority to sanction for conduct outside a proceeding.
Which case do you rely upon as being most persuasive on that subject?
The Minnesota Supreme Court case of Patton versus Newmar Corporation, the one that counsel mentioned, because counsel just actually totally misstates the holding of that case. That case specifically said, does the trial court have the inherent authority to sanction the plaintiff in this case by excluding their testimony of their expert because of actions that took place 3 years prior to the case beginning? So obviously that was not part of the proceeding when the spoliation took place. And the Supreme Court ruled the trial court was well within its authority to quantify the defendant's prejudice, which is in that case, and to fashion the sanction to exclude not only the testimony, but also the photographic evidence. And that was the sanction. It was for conduct that occurred outside the
confines. Okay, so it was a sanction based upon prejudice to a party. What specific prejudice is there here in your party?
My client had to incur legal fees that should not have had to have been incurred had her former spouse not acted as he did. And Mr. Gus has admitted in his reply brief that his client has not appealed whether his behavior meets the standards set forth in the inherent authority cases, because that's an exercise of discretion that is not likely to be reversed. So he's not even challenging that. You pointed out, Your Honor, you asked about the things that were said and so forth. Those are the conduct that occurred. And as a result of that conduct, because Mr. Robichaud would not do what he was obligated to do, and what he did is he said, I will do this if I get half of the money in the account that belongs to my daughter, because if she was any kind of a moral person, she'd repay it. And then he said, well, then we will charge you for my time to do this. And the trial court said, that doesn't make any sense at all. But one thing the trial court really pointed out that Mr. Gus does not deal with is that in the affidavit that Mr. Robichaud filed in connection with the hearing, the trial court found that he falsely stated facts. Now, the trial court found that statement in his affidavit, his paragraph 15 of his affidavit, which is found on addendum page 12. The trial court found in finding of fact 8, which is an addendum page 2, that he falsely alleges. Now, clearly, that's something that the trial court took into account in determining the conduct of Mr. Robichaud in this matter. It seems to me very clear, Your Honor, in response to your direct question, that Patton case controls. Patton was conduct outside of the proceeding, and the trial court specifically found a sanction, which the Supreme Court affirmed, and the sanction was to disallow the evidence. And the fact that the case got dismissed, that was not a sanction imposed by the trial court. The sanction was the exclusion of the evidence, and then without the evidence, the case was dismissed. But the Supreme Court made it very clear that the sanction was the exclusion of the evidence.
Are you familiar with any case, either in Minnesota or outside of Minnesota, where attorney's fees was considered an appropriate sanction for misconduct that occurred outside of a court proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. Two cases in Minnesota, both of which are unpublished by this court. One is called Bershaw, which counsel acknowledged. And in Bershaw, there were a number of factors that led the trial court to award fees. One of the factors was an allegation that the husband, and apparently proved that the husband, former husband, had broken into a family garage. And the Supreme Court said, I mean, the Court of Appeals said that was outside the scope of the proceeding because it predated it, but it took that as one of the factors in awarding attorney's fees. It's not directly on point, but it awarded attorney's fees for some part of the conduct that was before the proceeding. And in the other case is McGrath versus MICO, M-I-C-O, in which the Court of Appeals said we are awarding attorney's fees in part because the intent of the defendants in that case was to draw the plaintiff into costly litigation. Now, drawing him into the costly litigation occurred, obviously, before the litigation occurred. And this court held that fees could be awarded. And that was not a family court case, of course, but attorney's fees were awarded under the court's inherent authority. And it's for counsel to argue that the trial court does not have inherent authority to provide sanctions when the case law is replete with the trial courts doing that. And in Patton, the Supreme Court said, we have commented that courts are vested with considerable inherent judicial authority necessary to their vital function. The disposition of individual cases to deliver remedies for wrongs and justice freely and without purchase, completely and without denial, promptly and without delay, comfortably as to the law. And the task of determining what sanction is implicated by the broad authority provided the trial court. Trial courts have to have the authority to sanction the conduct. And in this case, as Judge Daly pointed out in her order, she would find this conduct bad by a non-lawyer. Here, Mr. Robichaud is a practicing attorney, and he provided this type of position to the trial court and falsely stated things in his affidavit. There's not much else for me to argue at this point unless the court has more questions, because I think the law really is the trial court has that implied authority. The patent case, absolutely, a phrase I learned in law school many years ago, as a case, it's all fours. It's on all fours with this case because it occurred 3 years before the proceeding. The court had power to exercise sanctions under its implied, and not implied, under its inherent authority.
Mr. Eisness, let me ask you this, Mr. Eisness. Even assuming we agree with you that the court can, in exercise of its inherent authority, consider attorney fees as a sanction for conduct that occurs outside of a proceeding, isn't there still a requirement that the district court make sufficient findings as to the reasonableness of the fee award so that review by this court is meaningful?
I think, Your Honor, the trial court did do that. And there are a number of cases that we pointed out in our brief with respect to what exactly the trial court has to find. But the trial court said the only available remedy that can fully cure the harm done by Robichaud's conduct and deter his bad conduct and defer future misconduct is the award of fees. The court, by agreeing to my affidavit as to the amount of fees that were charged, determined that those fees were reasonable because she awarded them all. If she had felt they were unreasonable, she wouldn't have awarded them all. And she had the right to do that. Now, the fact that she didn't make a finding and said those fees were reasonable, it's implied throughout her order that those fees were reasonable. If there are no further questions, I will not just argue to hear myself talk. I will just say thank you for your attention, Your Honors. And we respectfully request that the opinion and decision below be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gust, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I want to address some of the other issues, because I think we've covered the whether or not inherent authority exists. But I realize that I don't have the most terrific factual record, and that's frankly why, as Mr. Isis pointed out, you know, I'm not trying to argue that. I personally don't have children, and so I'm not trying to be judgmental of somebody who has a bad reaction when instead of his daughter calling him, gets a call from or gets an email from a divorce lawyer. But there are some things about the underlying facts that I think were not construed properly. Most significantly, the judge found that this contract was breached in August of 2019 when the funds were not transferred immediately. Now, the settlement agreement, all it says is that Paige becomes entitled to them, or I think the word was awarded to her. And as we pointed out in our brief, there are logical reasons why she wouldn't have wanted that money in August of 2019. And in fact, there was no request made for it in August of 2019. And that was never disputed. And so the finding that this contract was breached in August of 2019 is contrary to the plain language of the contract. And that is a de novo standard. The language says awarded to. Had this money been transferred in 2019, it becomes taxable and it also is subject to a penalty. If, on the other hand, Paige decided to go to graduate school, the money continued to be there. So how
was this awarded thing supposed to take place?
Well, the language, all it says is awarded to. And I think the expectation was that it would be spent for her senior year of college was the expectation. And so it would just be a matter of signing it over to Williams College. But if it was not used for college, it would get signed over to her. And I think that the expectation was when she wanted it, whenever she wanted it taken out of that tax-free account, that she could request it and he would turn it over to her.
The district court interpreted that agreement to require your client to transfer the college account. Isn't that right?
Yes. To transfer it as of August of 2019. And that's my contention, is that the language, the plain language just says awarded to, doesn't say transferred to, doesn't identify an account that it should be transferred into. It really just gives her the power to control it. Which
did the trial court interpret the transfer as requiring some conduct on his part?
Well, the trial court found it was a breach to have not transferred it in August of 2019. So I think the answer is yes. That's what the trial court's interpretation was that it was supposed to be transferred in August of 2019. But as I pointed out, that would actually have been bad, potentially, for Paige, because I assume that she now, since she's done with college, that money has become hers, but it stopped earning money tax, or stopped being tax-free and actually subject to a penalty if it's spent on something other than college. And so I think that that finding by the court was erroneous.
Did you note purposes that the trial court? Did you note that for appellate purposes that the trial court's not supported by the evidence?
You cut out a little bit, but I believe I know what you said. Yes, that was part of that we've contested the findings as well as the ability to make the conclusion. So yes, I think that's noted in our statement of issues and in our briefs. If I'm understanding you correctly, like I said, you cut out a little bit. So, with the last minute that I have, I do want to touch on the amount of the fees, because virtually all of this was driven by attorney's fees. Most of the fees were incurred after the money was already transferred. A substantial amount of the fees being claimed were for a motion that was denied. The actual motion that was granted was not based on the motion, or the actual order that was issued was not based on the arguments in the original motion. And it's just a very high number. The dollar amount prior to the first telephone conference was, by Mr. Isis's records, about $1,400. So as a result of the telephone conferences, a process was put in place in order to get the matter resolved, and it was resolved in relatively short order. And so as my time ticks out, we're here primarily because there's just no authority for this. But the reality is the rest of the judge's order reflects, just sort of a decision to punish conduct that she didn't like, and I don't believe that's an appropriate use of her judicial power. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory